I'll just serve as a conduit, recognizing people. You can either address one of the panelists or the panel, as it were. Yes, ma'am, we stand up.
Sure.
Are we able to pick this up all right?
All three of you. I just wondered, what are you from tax and taxation for juristers? Taxes then? What do you think? Is it all right to have tax exemptions for churches?
My view is that I think if you have tax exemptions for other private nonprofit entities, that to not provide the same exemptions for religious private nonprofit entities would be prejudiced against religion, and that is part of the Establishment Clause doctrine that says you can neither favor nor hinder religion. So my view is, if you give them just to religious institutions but not to other private nonprofit institutions, it's a mistake. But if you give it to all private nonprofit institutions, religious and non-religious and irreligious, and irreligious, then it doesn't violate the First Amendment, but that's just my view.
I agree. Taxation is a powerful weapon, and we have seen it used by a state in the early 19th century. The state of Maryland attempted to use taxation to kill the National Bank of the United States. And so since taxation is a weapon that could be used to stifle the growth or even eliminate an organization, surely you want to control that power exercised by the government. And as Marshall said, clearly, if the government is going to give tax breaks to nonprofits, it only makes sense to do the same with a religious organization.
Yes?
On the same subject, I'm not completely for tax exemption of all the business enterprises that some churches have. But I do seem to remember that one of the reasons that there was originally tax exemption for churches was what you said, that the government could tax a certain church out of existence if they didn't like it. So that was the origin of it, I think. And a comment about your wonderful story about the Continental Congressional Delegate from South Carolina, I forget his name now, but he was very good. In South Carolina, that was responsible for some of our rights. 3 years ago in South Carolina, a Jewish gentleman had to sue the state because he was, well, Jewish heritage, but he was of no religion, and he could not get his notary license without swearing allegiance to God. So that was in South Carolina, federal area courts, and he won. He's now a notary, also a college professor.
It's going to take me 2 or 3 minutes to get to my question, but I am getting to a question. I want to say that I do not support separation of church and state, or I should say religion and state. I teach at a Methodist college. I teach religion. And I have both Muslim and Christian students in my classes. They are allowed to express their beliefs. They are not allowed to denigrate the beliefs of those who are different. And I am even cautious when they want to say my faith is the true faith. Separation of church and state is not in the Constitution. What you read did not say anything about separation of church and state. The first words from this came from Thomas Jefferson in 1802 in a letter to the Danbury Baptist Association, and the letter was about that long, and he just said the First Amendment means that we should build a wall of separation between the church and the state. But we have no idea what he was talking about, because the rest of the letter doesn't tell you anything. It didn't come into court cases until the 1940s. The first Congress, the very early Congresses, did not separate church and state the way we think about it today. And even we don't have separation of church and state today, but I don't have time to list all of those. My question for any or all of you is, how do you define separation of church and state? And what does it mean if we were to have separation of church and state?
I'll respond to that. You're quite right. I'm glad
my students, both Muslim and Christian, do get federal funding in their loans.
Yes. I'm glad you made that point. I sometimes don't like particularly the phrase the wall of separation, because I think it suggests really an impossible situation. Historian Sidney Mead once suggested that a perforated line would be a more accurate kind of description of what we have and what we need to have. What we mean by minimally, we mean that the church, no religious body, is allowed to run, dictate, administer the state. Equally important, and for some maybe more important, the state is not allowed to dictate, run, and administer the religious community. And we need to accent the fact that for many, the whole idea of no established religion was a product of Enlightenment thinkers, the founding fathers, most of them deists, who were suspicious of traditional Orthodox religion, and dissenting Protestants, like Baptists, and both of these parties had bad experiences with established church. So they were clear that they did not want the government running the church. And just as important as some line protecting the state from the religious fanatics was the line protecting the church from an imperious state who likes to use whatever communities are around for its own purpose. So the minimal meaning is no one of these institutions runs, controls, dominates the other. The rest is we could talk all night. It's a constantly being negotiated thing, as Marshall indicates when he talks about these various court decisions that are made in response to particular cases that come up. That's not a full answer, but that's my first answer.
You are, Steve.
Our professor mentioned Thomas Jefferson and the phrase wall of separation. And what Jefferson was responding to is a letter sent to him by a Baptist association about a rumor that he had heard that there would be an established church in the United States. And Jefferson responded to that. I think what Jefferson was... 1802. What Jefferson said, from my understanding of the letter, was simply that there would not be a religious body established by Congress. But I'll say also, though, this notion of the First Amendment and the framers, it doesn't mean that this is a godless, you know, a godless, or ought to be a, how should I put it, a country whereby people, you know, cannot express their faith. When you look at the oath clause in the Constitution, clearly it indicates that there is an understanding that some people are going to believe, and they can swear an oath that is expressing their belief in God. Others may not feel comfortable doing that. They have the option of affirming. So, I mean, some people are going to believe, some people are not going to believe, and the point, I think, of it is that the government should not say everyone has to believe in order to participate.
I think that the most important thing about it, and what we've talked about a little bit here tonight, is what we're doing here tonight. I think it should be a continuing struggle to try and define the relationship between religion and government in this country. And so when I read about what's going on here in Raleigh, or what's going on in Chatham County, what's going on in some county courthouses in the Piedmont, in the western part of the state, and when I hear about things like your judge in Alabama, Roy Moore, these are the kinds of conversations that we ought to be having all the time. That's what that we ought to be continuously debating what the wall of separation of church and state means. But I'm not afraid of that language, and I'm not afraid of the continuing debate about it. It's when the debate stops that I'm a little concerned.
You may want to stand up, so we.
I have a strong voice. Could any of you speak to the financing of religion by government, particularly by the federal government? I know the education laws about providing an education, but primarily the faith-based kind of initiative, which looks like it will grow or can grow selective religions.
Well, where the court is right now is that if government's going to provide certain benefits, let's say in an educational setting, if the government's going to provide certain benefits, that it has to provide them equally to religious institutions, non-religious institutions, and a-religious institutions. And what the kind of institution is really irrelevant to the receipt of these government benefits. And so that's the court's attempt at neither favoring nor hindering religion. It seems to me that the problem with that notion is that you just don't, in a real world, you don't keep your money segregated. You know, if you're getting benefits, whether they're property benefits or money, to use for a non-religious purpose, for a secular purpose, computers, textbooks, whatever, that just means that's money that the institution doesn't have to spend on those things, and so it frees up more money, more of its own money, to spend on other things like the non-secular. Like the religious, so that's what's problematic about this notion that government benefits can be provided for secular purposes to all institutions, religious or non, because you're not either favoring or hindering religion. But it seems to me that in reality you are indeed favoring religion by providing those benefits that free up the religion's money that it would otherwise spend on those non-secular things to spend on religious things. And I think that does, in fact, favor religion. But that, again, that's just one person's view.
It's a very complicated and very difficult. And I must say I'm not on top of the latest developments with regard to President Bush's faith-based initiatives program. I don't think that's gone very far. But there are all sorts of programs around. Churches do refugee resettlement. Some of us are familiar with that. It's church agencies, the Lutheran Church, the Catholic Church. They get federal money to do that. We have daycare centers in churches all over the place. In fact, the vast majority of daycare centers in this state, I think nationwide, are located in churches. And the churches, it costs them some money. Churches put some effort in it. We have a center over at the church I'm a part of in Chapel Hill. And government money goes into not building the buildings, but scholarships to enable the children to go. And there's a desperate social need for these services. Now, and it really, I don't think it's mainly the case that frees up the money that churches would use. They wouldn't do the daycare, probably most of them, if they didn't have that kind of supplement. Does that benefit the religion? Well, I don't know. It might. I'm saying there's no hard and clear, you kind of have to weigh the danger of being pro church with the need for daycare, let's say. And our society is shot through with those kinds of arrangements, church-state entanglements.
Yes.
question of teachers in public schools with certain religious biases and the effect upon their students and the legality or non-legality of anyone who...
Teachers in schools...
Public schools.
Public schools with biases?
Their own particular religious take on the world. Having an impact on students.
Yeah, this is really not my field, and I wish we had more authority here. But my quick response is, are there any teachers without a worldview or some kind of religion? Don't we all have biases? Don't all teachers have biases, whether they're fundamentalist or secular humanist? I suspect their biases are communicated one way or another. Now, they're indirect, subtle ways of communicating biases, and they're overt ways. Certainly the more overt ways, you could clearly say that ought not to be done.
And how do you deal with it?
I'm glad I'm not a school principal. I don't know. I don't know how you deal with it. I really don't know. If I were a school principal and responsible, and I knew a teacher in my school was indoctrinating in some very overt way, well, I don't know. Maybe I would talk to him or her. But there's no way to turn school teachers into the valueless, non-religious people. If you understand religion in the broadest sense of belief in a certain way of life, that's going to be communicated. If it's anti-religion or hostility to religion, that will be communicated. I don't know how you can't get away from that. I don't see how you get away from that.
I would like to hear your views on the subject.
Yeah, you know more about it.
Oh, I'm not a teacher. Okay. I
taught in a federal school, and we had a teacher who sneaked books into the literature. Nikki Cruz, do you remember the name Nikki Cruz? She was teaching Nikki Cruz in her classroom in a federal school. The teachers complained because they went to the principal. I mean, you get the if you have a union, you also can do it that way. But you cannot. Indoctrination is one thing, but sneaking books that are not on the approved list is a little bit different.
That's clearly illegitimate. That clearly should not be done.
Right.
I agree with Reverend Kilburn. It's a difficult thing. I'm fairly unabashed in my political progressivism or liberalism, to use an old phrase. And when I started teaching at North Carolina Central, I thought a lot about it and how I would approach that in teaching constitutional law. I couldn't excise the Rehnquist opinions from the casebook, even no matter how much I wanted to. On the other hand, I was afraid that that if I wasn't honest with my students about my own political leanings and just deal with it up front, that it would sneak out in other ways, and I was concerned about that. So when I first started, my first year or two, I was very honest with my students about the fact that I was liberal. And there's a problem with it everywhere. And I took a different view. I ultimately decided that I had to not take the easy way out, that I had to work a lot harder at teaching the law objectively. And though I know I'm not going to be perfect at it, I think I'm a better professor as a result of making that decision. You know, I grew up Jewish in a small town in Georgia, and so I had experiences with school assemblies where some guy would come in and do yo-yo tricks for about 10 minutes, and then witness about Jesus and talking about how the Jews killed Christ. And I remember, a couple of occasions where I had to run away from some guy who suggested at knife point that I should accept Christ as my personal Savior. So, having experienced that kind of pressure as a student and having wrestled with it as a teacher, I ultimately concluded that we were a lot better off if teachers tried, and myself included, to be as objective as we possibly can.
As far as the teaching goes in the public schools, the problem I've found is that the teachers have a difficult time sometimes remembering that they are government employees, that they represent the government. And the students in their public school classes have their own religion, which is none of their business. And if they don't believe that, they will hear from some parents really quick. So I've spoken to many teachers, and very few of them realize they are government employees and represent the government. When they realize that, then everything else is easier to put into perspective.
You know, there's another side to this. I have a friend at Chapel Hill. Some of us know Warren Nord, who's a professor over there, and he's something of a specialist in religion and public education. He did a study some years ago of textbooks, high school and junior high school textbooks, as to and what he would find about how they treated religion in history and in economics. And he found there was a strong bias against religion, that you could read about Martin Luther King and not be told Martin Luther King was a Christian minister. You could read about economics and not read about the Catholic bishop's pastoral on economic justice or other church-related views with regard to economic justice. Here was the case of the state so eager to not have religious bias, in fact, to try to stay away from the whole subject altogether. How the teachers use these books, I don't know. But he found a strong anti-religious bias, which he wrote extensively about, and I can't adequately present his research, but that's another side to that.
Now they barely teach history because it's not on end of grade tests.
Yes, Lily.
Professor Duggan, is it neutrality when a civic or a municipal board holds prayers before meetings? Is that neutrality, even if they have people from different faiths doing the prayers?
Well, no. But the law is that it's not a First Amendment violation. Now, why is that the law? It's a law because when the case went before the United States Supreme Court, Chief Justice Warren Burger said, "Well, the very first Congress that passed the Constitution and sent it to the states for ratification, the same Congress that passed the First Amendment and sent it to the states for ratification, had a chaplain and opened every morning." Every session of Congress each morning with a prayer from the chaplain. So they could not have intended the First Amendment to preclude that. And so it's an anomaly. It's the one thing that the court has said, because of history, because of this quirk of history, we're not going to interpret the First Amendment in a way that would be inconsistent with how the framers understood the First Amendment, or what the court at that time thought the framers understood the First Amendment to mean. So it's not neutral, but neither is it a violation of the First Amendment. What is a violation of the First Amendment, however, is making that prayer too sectarian. A town in South Carolina last year or a year or 2 years ago passed an ordinance that their invocation had to be in Jesus' name, and the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit struck that ordinance down. Town of Great Falls, South Carolina, I believe, struck that ordinance down and said that even though you can begin these legislative meetings with some sort of an invocation, it can't be that sectarian.
Yes.
Children on the foundation of the future tomorrow, And the thing that worries me, instead of everybody concentrating on, well, my religion's better than the other, when you say religion to me, I think of God, humanity, and love for mankind, and doing good deeds. That's religion, no matter what aspect of religion you're into. And I don't know why people just can't come together and be united and just say, spiritual one above, thank you for this day, to protect our family and our home, and bring us a better day and a good government where it encompasses everybody. And you can't please everybody. There's no entity when you're in a governmental position that you can satisfy every percentage point of the population. Somebody somewhere is going to be left out. So, yes, I agree that maybe people that are non-believers of the Bible or religion, your atheist, for instance, might be left out. But is it fair to 99% of the population that Mother Mary, what's her name, Mary O'Hara, was it? Madeline O'Hara, stood up in 63 and had it taken out of all the school systems for everybody, one person, an atheist, which was 1% of the population. I think we need to stand united instead of divided and think of something we can say spiritually that would encompass all religions and look at all religions as equal, and that if you have a religion and faith in a religious being, that you're doing good for the humanity of mankind, the salvation of your country, your nation, and the world.
Comments?
Well, you know, the problem is that those 1% shouldn't have to feel like that they don't fit in, that they don't belong, not when it comes to government. You know, there's a somebody quipped, I wish I knew who said it, but it's a great line that, you know, religion hasn't been thrown out of schools. You know, anybody that's ever taken a math test knows that there's a religion in schools. And so there's nothing in the Constitution and nothing in any Supreme Court case that says that people can't pray. It just can't be government led or government organized.
Well, I didn't expect to speak on it, but I'm been a chaplain paid by the state of Connecticut in Texas, and to work in the psychiatric hospitals. And we chaplains by ourselves always got along fine, speaking from our hearts as fully and as deeply and as we liked. But of course, we each knew what faith background of the person was who was leading at that particular time. And we didn't have to water anything down or be afraid of stepping on somebody's toes. And yet we did, of course, help each other, be we Muslim, Jewish, or Christian. But this did carry over when we would say I would give an invocation at what was a community group where I didn't know the faith backgrounds of these people, and they didn't know mine. And then I would say up front, like you did, what I was. The important occasions like this and Jesus of Nazareth call me to pray at such a thing. If you will, join me. It does uplift the morals and the ethics and the friendship and the community feeling of everyone there. But of course, we're not indoctrinating anybody and have power over people to believe.
Anybody want to respond? Have to.
I just wanted to get back to what you were saying, Marshall, about the situation here in Raleigh. And I think in the morning paper, the person who lines up the invokers said that what he did was he went to the yellow pages and selected people. I don't know if it was using a random procedure from that's what he did. Well, that is fair to the religious, but the I don't think there are any atheists or agnostics or non-believers listed under heaven. And I was wondering about the appropriateness of leaving out those categories of persons.
Well, you know, in my opening remarks, I talked about this debate about whether the First Amendment should be interpreted to be neutral as to one religion over another, or should also include being neutral as between religion and non-religion. And that's really the heart, your question goes to the heart of that interpretive problem. Here, and I suppose it seems to me that one can be just as patriotic, whether one says one nation under God or whether one says one nation indivisible. And that the blood that gets spilled on the battlefield is the same whether the person says one nation under God, as we have since 1954, or whether the person says one nation indivisible, as we said the Pledge of Allegiance before 1954. So I'm sensitive to the notion that government ought not to favor not only one religion over another, but government ought not to favor religion over non-religion. That being said, all of these debates I think would be more interesting if the folks who were engaging in the debates all thought about how they would feel if the city council or county commission meetings were opened with Wiccan prayers on a daily basis, and how they would feel about that. And if they just put themselves in those shoes once in a while, it might make for a more interesting debate.
We're going to close at 9 o'clock sharp. I wonder if there are other questions all the way in the back.
We've been reading recently about political parties soliciting church membership directories. And I at least think of political parties as government. So I wonder if you could speak to that from the issue both of privacy and of church and state.
I don't think there's anything illegal about that. I think it's bad church policy for a church to become so aligned with a particular political party. I think the church loses a bit of its soul, or any church that does that, that gets so lined up with one particular political party. But if it chooses to do that, I don't think we have any, not sure we have any legal recourse. You might question its if that's done to a certain extent, it might reach the point where its tax exempt status as a church becomes questionable. I guess then that would get into a legal kind of decision. And for that reason, the kind of church organizations I have been associated with that do advocate for public policies are always very careful not to simply be a wing of the Democratic Party or a wing of the Republican Party and so on.
I just want to emphasize that that's the tightrope that churches have to walk, if they become overly politicized, whether someone would disclose this to the IRS and then they lose their tax-exempt status. I guess that's the big question.
I don't think I can add anything to what you said.
Time for one more question. Yes, ma'am.
This is to the history professor. I'm guessing you know where we've been. From a historical standpoint, do you have any feeling for where we're going in that history?
I think the woman sitting to the right touched upon a very important subject, and that is that our religion doesn't have to be, you know, I am a Muslim, or I am a Buddhist, or I am a Christian. Perhaps if our religion was more like, and I don't know the Unitarians, or, but was something else, because we can communicate, and whoever the Creator is can experience us, and we can experience the Creator without ever talking about, we have to talk about the blood of Jesus. I think that's a part of the problem. And I think where we're going, my feeling is that we are evolving, not only as a country, but as a world, in spite of all of the things we hear about today throughout the world. We're very different. And I know that. I told you where I'm from. And not only are we different racially, but we're becoming different spiritually. So where are we going? I think we're going to see something quite different in the future, where we speak a language of faith and hope and all of these things, but it may not have to be my religious order that you have to obey, or your religious order that we have to obey. That's what I feel.
Two, and we'll take those to close. Loretta, and then in the very back.
Just more of a comment. I'm a longtime member of the American Civil Liberties Union, and so I believe in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And I'm not much of a student of history, but what little I know, it seems to me that if we didn't have that protection in the First Amendment of religion, non-religion, people not being forced to have a particular religious belief, that our country would not have lasted as long as it has. That's my firm belief.
Thank you, brother. And the last comment in the back or question?
Actually, it's a good question. Since the professor mentioned that in the early 1800s, the Supreme Court basically disallowed state organized enhanced religions, whatever. And I was just curious, was there a substantial backlash against that? Had it fallen out of favor, or is that just a piece of history that's been excised from my 10th grade learning?
The established churches of the states.
I think he's missing the point. The states, some of them had established religions at the time of the Constitution, so they didn't establish them in reaction against.
No, what I'm saying though is it became disallowed. Was there a backlash against that?
What was the struggle?
Well, you know, a couple of things quickly. The states, we're talking about eastern states actually, as opposed to western states. Eastern states had to change for a number of reasons. You know why? They were losing their population to new states coming out, opening up in the West. For example, one of the states that I know best is Ohio. Ohioans can brag that they didn't have religious tests and those kinds of things as Eastern states had. So Eastern states, and not only change about religion, but change about other restrictions that were in their constitutions, restrictions about voting, various things. So they had to change.
When I grew up with blue laws, I am from Massachusetts. Uh-huh. I grew up with blue laws, mm-hmm. which all are based on religion.
Right. Does that make sense, sir?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Great opportunities in the West. Eastern states had to adjust their laws, and by the early 1800s, many of them did.
Long before the Constitution was written, spoke about freedom not only to practice religion, but not to practice religion, and set that idea, made that idea a foundation in Rhode Island. and I think contributed to the thinking that went into the Constitution. And I think it's important not to just define it as religion, but that 1% had a champion long before there was a Constitution.
Thank you for that. I hope you could see from this final presentation how serious these three take this issue, and I guess the message is that we have to keep struggling with this, that it's an ongoing kind of problem we ought to be confronting and examining and investigating, talking about, debating. Hopefully we'll continue to do that. I'd like to thank the panel very much. Hope you will.